got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you for episode 165. 165, Kevin, of the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. How are you, my friend?
Oh, we are exactly halfway to 330. No, everything is totally awesome. And you know what's really nice is we have been receiving a lot of feedback, either Twitter or other social media about this podcast. We don't have a site for this or an email box for this. So they reach out to you, reach out to me. But the thing that's really been really nice is that people are sharing this work. And as content creators in social media and in media in general, we are half the equation. It's the people that listen and the people that share and the people that retweet and the people that put it on their Facebook page that really help us fulfill our mission. And so, you know, we thank you very much for all the kind words and really encourage you to continue to share this work if you find it useful. Someone today said that they didn't know if they liked it more for the science or the humor. And so that either says the humor is really good or the science is really bad.
Now I'm getting subconscious. Like I'm going to start trying too hard to be funny and I'm going to ruin it. I got to not do that, Kevin. You got to help me.
No. Well, actually, I mentioned to somebody today on Twitter that expect continued flow of good scientific information, but do not expect any additional things that are funny because they're unplanned. And they're also, that way you will not suffer from disappointment. Every laugh is a gem.
They can't all be zingers, folks. That's all we're saying. We can study and we can come up with good scientific content, but sometimes the jokes, they're just going to fall flat and you got to accept that. But we got some great stories to talk about. So let's dive into these. So first up, a science-backed case in support of organic farming. Next, why health experts say you can ignore the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen list. And finally, children with deadly immune disorders remain healthy a decade after receiving novel gene therapy. All really interesting stuff, Kevin. Tell us about this first story, which drove me nuts to read, I have to be honest.
Well, the thing for me was it was really disappointing because when the article said a scientist makes a case for farming and gardening organically, this is by Dr. Charles Merrifield, this was something that I thought I want to know the case. You know, I want to know what they think because a lot of times I'm defending organic, farming and organic production. For me, I understand what some of the advantages are and I was hoping to learn some of the other ones. And for me, just to be clear, the advantages is that people are learning to grow food in a different way. And they're doing research in areas that may not be tested if they were allowed the access to synthetic fertilizers and synthetic crop protection strategies or, you know, insect control, fungal control. And so we're learning these alternative ideas and we're learning a lot about the value of cover crops and crop rotation, intercropping that can be beneficial, the roles of different insects and beneficial insects and different fungicides. There are different strategies to approaching fungicide or antifungal technology. Anyway, long story short is I have a lot of respect for the organic farmers I know. And I was thinking, all right, I'll throw another arrow in my quiver when I read this in-depth, insightful article that's scientifically based. And instead, I was somewhere between trying to laugh and puke at the same time. This guy, it's so full of internal contradictions. I don't know that he even proofread it himself, but it starts out with just a appeal to, the bandwagon fallacy. It says organic farming is been around for more than a century and everyone does it. And 1.5% of the farmland does it. And that there's this many hectares. So, we're onto something there. And then makes the argument that people who are against it are not making an argument that is scientific. They're making an argument based on ethics, and that the, or people who do it, people who engage in organic farming, they're not doing it because it's science-based. They're doing it because it's ethics that are there, and science can't predict or judge ethics. And I kind of disagree there, because I think we take in evidence from a scientific approach that we then apply to different scenarios to determine whether or not we're making ethical decisions. Ethics are not just what we think or what we believe, but ethics are determined by choices that we make that are informed. And so this is where this entire article just falls flat, like one of our jokes. It just falls flat. And so the basis and the premise that he establishes just doesn't hold. And then at the end, he comes back in and says, well, it's all science-based. Organic is all science-based. So, you know, that's it in a nutshell, but I'd love to hear your take on this.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin. Yes, I do. I can't stand this article. That's where we're going to begin. So I have four primary complaints, and I, of course, I want your input on all of them. But to the point you were addressing, this is a quote. He says, as a philosophy and a values-based ethical system, organics can't be unscientific, as it is impossible for any value system to be either scientific or unscientific. Okay, fair enough. I think as a general statement, that's correct. But his alternative is, this is why we need democracy, right? We need democracy because science can't determine these questions. But looking at this logically, democracy is more people saying one thing than another group of people. So this is not an objective standard for determining if something's correct. So like, Kevin, if you and I and a few other people went out to lunch and the rest of us voted that you got to pay for it, we'd be like, okay, well, you know, that's ethical because more of us said Kevin gets to buy our food. It's not, that doesn't make any sense to me. And the final thing I'll say, and then jump back in here. When we critique organic farming, when you say like this crop grown under organic conditions yields 40% less than the conventional counterpart, you're not making an ethical statement about whether it's wrong to eat the organic version of that produce or whatever, but you're making an assessment, a scientific technical assessment that says when you grow this way, you get less of what you're growing. It's just a simple fact. So I think if anyone's twisting things up and using flawed logic here, it's Dr. Charles here, who, by the way, I'd love to have on the show. Maybe we could talk to him sometime. But I'll stop. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I thought the same thing. I'd love to talk to him individually, because organic farming or organic production is not an ethical set of, or not some sort of philosophy. And maybe if you go back to Rudolf Steiner and those kinds of crackpots, maybe it was. But in the modern age, it is a production method. It is a way that you produce crops, and that has a basis in how do you leverage the best science to answer these questions with all of these restrictions. You can't use this, can't use this, can't use this. You got these tools in your toolkit, go. And how do you make the best of that? And to me, that's admirable. I mean, you're playing the game with one hand tied behind your back, and you're doing well. No problem there. But I totally disagree with that, with his approach. And when he says, you know, that one of the quotes was, this is why we have democracy, because if it was science that could decide ethical questions, we would not need politicians. So what he's arguing for is, let's use obfuscation and skewed tactics of politics and the spin and the bending of ideas to dictate our decisions rather than evidence. And this is where I think the article is an insult to organic farmers who use science-based approaches, who make decisions based on evidence, playing again with that limited toolbox to be able to produce food. I kind of give up there.
The point about Rudolf Steiner is worth dwelling on for a second, because he talks about how for many cultures and even many individual farmers, agriculture is almost theological. And he actually uses that phrase, right? This is a system of beliefs, and it has a spiritual connotation. And that's not the realm of science. But I want to make this clear, because I'm a deeply religious person. I go to church every weekend. It's a fundamental part of how I view the world. But my beliefs are not immune from criticism. You know what I mean? So if I said something dumb that was attached to my religious beliefs and Kevin said, "That's a little dumb, Cameron," I couldn't be like, "Well, you know, it's spiritual, so you can't critique it with your science methods." That is not a plausible analysis or a reasonable analysis of what's going on here. You know, so you can say that something is outside the realm of science, but nothing is immune from logical scrutiny. So all that to say, I think you made a better case for organic farming in about 12 seconds at the top of this story than he did in, I don't know, 1500 words.
Well, I agree with you. But folks like Stephen Jay Gould and others would say that science and religion are two separate magisteria that can't really find any overlap in the Venn diagram, that you have to treat them individually. And that's what this guy is really doing here. He's treating organic farming as a religion and as a unassailable set of realities that are based on faith rather than and belief rather than on the hard science. And so much of that is where the rest of this article comes from, where he says, it's an ecosystem, and it's an ecosystem based on diversity, and it has to be an ecosystem, and makes that whole argument for, like, you know, the agroecology argument, when really the plants that they're producing have absolutely zero harmonization with, I'm saying most likely, I mean, I'm thinking this guy's in England, but maybe here in the States, that there's no harmonization between the crops that are planted and what's natively grown on that land, and who are the native pollinators and who are the native pests. It is all artificial. We have created an artificial system. Farming is an artificial system, and we do it because we want to feed ourselves and feed other people and expand the bounty. We're using the land as a source to produce more for others. And so that's why this just drives me absolutely nuts. He talks about biodiversity being so critical. And I don't get that argument necessarily, because we've even shown with genetically engineered crops like BT crops that you increase the diversity of the insects in that field, because you're not killing everything with a broad spectrum insecticide. You're focusing specifically on the crop, on the insects that are damaging the crop. So I would almost argue that BT from the plant, from the crop, is the same thing that they use. Well, I know it is the same thing they use in organic farming, because it affects only the insects that chew on that crop, the herbivores on that crop. So it has exactly the same impact. And so this article just kind of made me crazy. It was, when you start looking at it, it really was just another tome against large agriculture. And, you know, they make the argument, okay, soil is complex and you have to build soil. Of course. And, you know, farmers everywhere do this. Farmers, you know, need good soil and respect that soil. I mean, granted, you plant the same thing in it every year sometime, but you use fertilizers that enhance it as a growing medium. Anyway, you're talking to a guy whose family has a farm on sand. So, you know, but this article basically was really left me disappointed.
One other thing I want to talk about. Well, first you said, you made a point about biodiversity, and maybe you know different than I do, but I haven't seen any study in any reputable journal that supports the claims that he's making. Every study I've seen basically says, if you're going to grow organic on a large scale, like Europe was proposing to do before this war in Ukraine broke out, it is inevitably going to result in an expansion of cropland. And overall, that's bad for biodiversity. The more farming you have to do, the more land you have to farm. This is not good for all the critters and all the microorganisms that live where you're proposing to grow more food. And he doesn't address this. And he doesn't address any legitimate criticism that I've heard from people who are not ideologues, but like an agricultural economist at a reputable school who does good work in this area. He doesn't interact with any of this material. And I found that bothersome.
No, you're exactly right. That when you have to expand the amount of land used to take away from natural ecosystems of a given area to expand organic gardening or organic farming, Or even with in the big one that we see with transgenic crops, it's the other end of the spectrum, that they've made farming easier to do on a larger scale with fewer inputs, so a single farmer can expand their space and be able to use technology along with these genetic tools to take up a little bit more adjacent prairie, or in South America to bulldoze more areas of rainforest to grow soybeans. So yes, you know, we understand that there are impacts on biodiversity and on diverse natural ecosystems by farming, but that's why we have to use the tools of efficiency rather than the tools of here's what I believe. And I think this is where science comes in and where we're actually working very hard to respect ecology and respect the environment and do more with less. Organic farming can be part of that. We're learning things from organic production, but overall it's going to be an integration of the best techniques, not just an ideological adherence to one doctrine that is restrictive in the tools that it can use.
Before we move on, I just want to point out very quickly that he makes a nuclear bomb analogy. I don't know what it is with people who share his perspective. They love talking about nuclear bombs as a comparison to biotechnology or as like an appropriate reference for what we're talking about. And the point he was making is, you know, we don't say scientifically we can determine whether we should drop a nuclear bomb or not. And I understand that. And that's correct, right? You can't say anything ethically based on what you know about the physics and whatever of nuclear weapons. I understand that. But looking at genetically engineered crops, for example, you can say, well, if we use these seeds, we're going to get this much more food, or we're going to get, if you know, we're going to use this much less pesticide or something like that. And then you can make an ethical judgment based on the data that you've gathered. So I just wanted to throw that out there in passing. Any final thoughts before we move on to?
Well, just to tie in with that, I think that there were ethical decisions that were made in 1945 around the dropping of atomic bombs, and we can look back on them and debate them at you know Monday morning quarterback this thing from, you know, whatever it is, 80 years out. But there were decisions about, you know, how long will this war go on? Will a ground invasion of Japan result in more casualties, or is this something that we just put a big punctuation mark on right now? You know, I wasn't there. My dad barely was. The bottom line is that there were ethical decisions that were driven by the data. And so these ethical decisions were looked at. You had science, you had people in government poring over the data and military experts weighing the costs to both the Japanese as well as the American troops and how long this war would go on, how expensive it would be. And this use of a nuclear weapon may have actually decreased the length of a very tragic war, tragically. And, you know, I think it was a horrible chapter in human history. It's one that I hope we never go back to. But I think his analogy falls flat when you do consider that those atomic weapons were an ethical decision.
We need to come up with a fancy Latin phrase for what people do when they use nuclear weapons in an argument, like argument ad nuclear bombium or like something, you know what I'm saying? Cause we've got one for Hitler. We need to come up with one. It's like, oh, it's a fallacy. Yeah. There you go. We patented a fallacy.
It's like Godwin's law, right? We'll have to think about that. I'll have to come up with that. Okay, good. We'll get on it.
Okay. Well, speaking of fallacious scientific claims, Environmental Working Group is back with their Dirty Dozen.
And I don't care if they publish a Dirty Dozen. I just wish that every single news channel wouldn't go play it all over the place without considering what it really means. The media loves this list, and I can't figure out why. It impugns the integrity of perfectly safe produce that people need to be eating, and instead says your strawberry, spinach, kale, nectarines, apples, and grapes are basically killing you. And they don't say that, but that's the implied message, is that these are dirty crops, right? This is the Dirty Dozen. So this isn't a report that comes out every year from the Environmental Working Group. And what they do is they analyze USDA data. And USDA collects data on residues found on many different crops, and they report this in an annual report. EWG takes that report and goes through it, and anytime something is detected, they count that as present. That's true. But what they'll end up saying is, on strawberries, we detected 53 different chemicals. Ugh, 53 different chemicals on the strawberry you're giving to your kid. That's not true. That across the United States, they may have detected a residue of one of those 53. But in total, maybe there's 53 that show up. Some may be sprays from adjacent fields because our detection is extremely sensitive. Others may be regional differences in the different pests and pathogens that they have to deal with. In Florida, you might have a problem with fruit flies, and in Michigan, you got a problem with macrophomina fungus, you know. And so but the environmental working group implies that detection is evidence of poison or toxicity. The problem is that all of these are way below the acceptable limits, hundreds to thousands of times below limit. And the only time it exceeds the acceptable daily intake numbers is on an extremely small set of data from an extremely small set of fruits. So what the USDA data say are, our data assure you that your produce is safe. What environmental working group is they say, here are the dirty ones you got to avoid. And the article that was written in the article that appeared in the Genetic Literacy Project was from the Alliance of Food and Farming that really talks about why you need to ignore it. And I think I gave some of the summary there, but you know, we can go through it a little bit more in detail if you like. So what do you think?
I want everyone to do a little homework when you hear this episode. I want you to Google Carl Winter, Dirty Dozen. And Dr. Winter is a retired toxicologist from UC Davis, and he's written some papers breaking down the methodology that Environmental Working Group uses. And by comparison, he explains how the EPA sets the limits of pesticide exposure. And it's a really extensive process. So everybody read this. It'll give you a good overview. But here's just the Reader's Digest. And there's two aspects to this. So the first is, they do animal studies where they shove rats full of pesticide. it's cruel. I understand why some animal rights people are freaked out by this, but they basically give rats enough of an insecticide until they see some sort of a biological effect. And then they keep giving it to them until they see some kind of a harmful effect. And once they have these two limits established, they set what's called the reference dose by lowering it like 100 or 1,000 times below whatever the no observed effect level is. And once they have that reference dose, then they have the manufacturer of the chemical do field trials where they're spraying this pesticide and they're trying to establish tolerances. And basically, farmers or pesticide applicators, however they use this pesticide, the tolerance that the EPA sets, if they do set one, it has to fall below this reference dose. So this is a very extensive regulatory process. It costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. There is field work that has to be done, as I said, and then there's all of these animal studies that have to be done because the reality is that pesticide manufacturers don't want people to get sick. And my reasoning is that they're normal people. They have families. They don't want people to get sick. But if you want to look at it just from an economics perspective, they don't want to get sued. They don't want to harm their customers. That's a bad business model. You know, it's just not good. And then the EPA, and I've been very critical of the EPA in a lot of my writing, but they're humans too, right? They don't want people to get sick. And a lot of them go into that work, going to work for a regulatory agency like that because they see themselves as looking out for the public, right? So with a little bit of common sense and a little understanding about how pesticide regulation actually works, you can walk away from this Dirty Dozen garbage and just go, I don't need to worry about this anymore.
Yeah, if anything, it assures you your food is safe, right?
Right.
I mean, it really is exactly the opposite. What it does say is that everything is good. and that we live in very blessed times to have the food we have. It's kind of funny. I actually wrote something. I hope to publish it shortly, called Fulta's working group, Toxic 10. and I'll just give you a little taste of this. A chemical that is that every year, 50,000 cases of the toxic 10 are reported to poison control centers, and they're found ubiquitously in the American diet, especially in fruits and vegetables. And you can't wash it off. I mean, these are chemicals that are in the food, and you can't pronounce most of them. And they're listed in the hazardous substances database. So, you know, this is the toxic 10. One of them is pyridoxine. Pyridoxine, you know, it sounds evil right there. High in chickpeas. It's in leafy greens. It's in carrots. It's been detected in all of these. There's been neurological effects that have been shown in animal studies. It's been shown to induce seizures, cause peripheral nerve sensitization, difficulty in walking and gait, control of movements in overdoses, result in convulsions, diarrhea, and muscle weakness. It's vitamin B6. But if you feed rats tons of vitamin B6, they show these effects. And even in humans, if you overdose on vitamins, you can have negative effects. You know, vitamin A is a great example, or vitamin E. But I basically list the toxic 10, which are vitamins that you need to live, yet have toxicity in extreme cases, and have been shown in animals which have been force-fed the damn things to show certain signs of toxicity. It says the dose makes the poison, and that's the main point of the article. But in the hands of the nefarious and the agenda-driven, something like the toxic 10 would be convincing people to not eat carrots, chickpeas, and leafy greens because they're loaded with this pyridoxine stuff that's going to kill you.
There you have it. Environmental Working Group, for as long as they've been around, is full of an eight-letter word.
Well, the funny part is I've met one of the folks in the Environmental Working Group, I think a vice president, and, you know, nicest guy in the world and smart. And I would ask him, like, why do you do this? Well, just this business. It's what we do. And, you know, I mean, it's almost like they know it's deceptive, but it keeps the funds rolling in. And, you know, I don't know that every campaign they have is completely as bankrupt as this one. You know, they do a lot of work with looking at water and other stuff. So it is unfortunate that they have to use this deceptive annual fear of food message in order to achieve their goals.
It's all bad. Everything they do is bad. To the extent that they do anything helpful, they are reproducing the work of an actual scientific organization. So I wouldn't trust anything that they put out. My colleague, Dr. Josh Bloom at the American Council on Science and Health, has written extensively about some of their other campaigns that are more in the realm of like medicine and makeup and cosmetics. Yeah.
You know, cell phones. I think they went after cell phones for a while.
I don't remember that one specifically, but it's basically, like, if your methodology is bad in one sphere or like one field that you work in, it's usually bad in all of them. And that's what you find, is they just identify certain hazards and they say, you're exposed to this. And they don't actually tell you how much. And then they go, you know, therefore buy your makeup and your other home goods products from our sponsors, which you can follow at this link. Okay. I'm done ranting. Kevin, let's talk about something that's really encouraging.
No, you're right. So the other article is, children with a deadly immune disorder remain healthy a decade after being treated with gene therapy. And this is by Sarah Williams in the Genetic Literacy Project. And there's a disease that's very rare called ADASCID, and it's adenosine deaminase deficient severe combined immunodeficiency. So a very catchy
really rolls
term
off
there.
The tongue, huh?
Rolls off yours. But the bottom line is, it is a really awful disease in infants that's genetically based. It has usually associated with impaired immune function, a general failure to thrive, other types of actual physiological problems like lymphocytopenia, other stuff. But the children usually die by the age of 2 years. And basically, you don't have a good immune system. And it's caused by mutations in a gene that controls this adenosine deaminase. It's an enzyme that's important to have functioning for the immune system. And babies with the disease, if you're exposed to any germs, you're wiped out. This is, boy in the plastic bubble stuff here. It was John Travolta. It was Vinnie Barbarino in the bubble before he was Vinnie Barbarino. Boy. And usually it's lethal by 2 years old, right? And so right now when a baby is born and diagnosed with this, they have to survive by actually being injected with the enzyme. So they get a dose of the adenosine deaminase every, a couple times a week. So going to a doctor or to a hospital to get shots of the enzyme, that's how you do it. And it's expensive. It's, troublesome for the parents and the kid, whatever. You can have a more durable therapy if you can find a matched blood donor or a bone marrow donor. You can get but you have to have a HLA match and all that stuff. And it's only a small number of patients that actually have this level of match. So it also opens you up once if you get a bone marrow transplant, you're looking at graft versus host disease, all the other things that can happen. You have to take immunosuppressive medications, all the other complications that are potentially there. So it is really tricky. So this is the basis for the treatment that they tried.
So I believe, and it's very rare that I get to say this, Kevin, I believe that this is one of the few very successful gene therapies that we get to talk about on this show. And I think it was something like 90% of the patients in this clinical trial fared really well with this therapy, to the point that after a decade, they did not need any other treatment. They were more or less, I don't know if you want to call it a cure. I think that's probably premature. But they were effectively treated, and they don't struggle with this anymore. Is that right?
Well, yeah, sort of. So 90% is 9 out of 10. So they treated 10 infants with this rare disease. So it's not like they're falling out of wombs everywhere. This is a pretty rare thing, and they were able to treat 9 out of 10. The 10th one was a child or a young woman at 15, and it didn't work for her. So what this suggests is that this particular gene therapy has a developmental window when it is most likely to become durable. And they've done some more work since. Now, this is the original work. I don't remember the time they did the original work, but it was a while ago. And these kids are now, a decade later. But they've done more analysis in other populations since and actually show this therapy is very good. And actually getting better through improved viral vectors. So the way in which the gene is delivered and fewer off-target effects, other potential downsides that were in this original cohort. The other interesting part about this is that this is done from an autologous donor. You give your own bone marrow cells. They modify them with a virus that puts in, installs the correct version of the adenosine deaminase. And then now those blood cells, just like when we talked about sickle cell disease, those new stem cells that have been genetically modified go back into the body, you inject them into the bloodstream, and they mysteriously find their way into the bone marrow. It's really kind of cool how that works. And once they get in the bone marrow, they start to replicate. And now they basically populate your bone marrow reservoirs with this, with the new bone marrow that gives rise to additional hematopoietic events or blood manufacturing events that contain the correct enzyme. So that's why this thing works so well. And if you can do this in an infant, it looks like it works pretty well.
It's really cool. I have two questions that I'm hoping you can answer. Maybe not, but I'm wondering why would it be more effective in children who are younger? Like, what's going on at the molecular level that would explain that? And then, why would the viral vector affect the efficacy of the treatment? Like, and they mentioned this in the story that if you can use a different virus, it may improve how well the treatment works. So I'm wondering if you can address those.
Yeah. So let's start with the second one. Different viral vectors have different ways of integrating their payload into native DNA, and they've gotten better with time. And instead of placing these things in giant arrays or maybe in multiple places throughout the genome or coming along with extra baggage that can have other effects on cell cycle or cell growth, they have gotten better. So the newer viral vectors have less of a chance of collateral effects than the old school technologies. So that's the first one. What was the first question you asked me?
The first question, it's the end of the week. We get tired too, everybody. The first question was, why would it be more effective in children that are younger?
So when you're young, you have much more plasticity in your immune system as well as in your stem cell population, I'm guessing, that when you do this in someone who's already have a highly differentiated and terminally differentiated immune system that's had a immune system which has stood up to many different challenges, you're probably seeing a response to the payload that's been introduced because now you're introducing a foreign protein. This is in the infant is probably more likely to grab without being an insult to the body's own immune system. Just a guess. The immune system is like, if you put all the stuff I know about biology and medicine in a hierarchy, immune system is the thing that I know least about, but it is the coolest part. And I still know a bunch, but it's still super weird and mysterious to me. So, but that's my guess. And I'm sure someone will let us know if we're wrong.
it's a good guess. I think mine was along the same lines, but just way less sophisticated than what Kevin just said. But, you know, to your credit or in your defense, maybe it sounds like they're still not certain either. You know, they're still trying to refine the treatment. And I think the lead researcher specifically said, you know, we've got a new viral vector. We're improving X, Y, and Z, and we're confident that it's going to get better in the coming years. So that's awesome. Very good news after those two terrible stories that we dealt with up front. I'm encouraged by this. Who are you following on Twitter?
Well, let me just, you know, jump in on that last point really quick is that, you know, when we talked about the development of organic farming and organic production and research in those areas, it wasn't because we knew that organic farming was going to be better tomorrow or be more productive tomorrow, but they're baby steps with the idea of trying to solve an important problem. And that is, and that's the same idea in this story here. They're taking baby steps, and maybe it's not going to make everything exactly 100% better tomorrow, but it at least gives us the opportunity to develop the tools and improve them. And so in that way, you know, it's a good thing. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good point. Just to say, we're not anti-organic farming, you know, there's a market for it. And Kevin made it, I think you made a very solid point, which is like, you kind of put artificial constraints on yourself and it forces you to find a new solution to your problems. That's a perfectly reasonable answer to me. We don't hate organic farming. I think that's a bit of a fallacy. Anyways, sorry.
Well, who am I following? I'm following Britt Marie Hermes. And I forgot about Britt for a little bit. I ran into her on Twitter this week. And Britt is at Naturo Diaries, NaturoDiaries. Britt is a PhD student in Germany now, yet at one time in her life was a naturopath and was delivering bogus therapies to people and really felt that she was delivering bogus therapies and saw the people around her developing bogus therapies. And she called it out and received a tremendous amount of pushback, even some lawsuits. And I commend her on her bravery and hope that you follow her and learn more about her old story because she really is a hero in science. So who are you following, Cameron?
I'm following a philosopher named Edward Fazer. He is at Fazer Edward. I see what he did there. And it's just F-E-S-E-R is his last name, and Edward is spelled how you think it is spelled. But he writes a lot about the philosophy of science, which is pertinent to that first story we were talking about. What's the relationship between philosophy and science? Do they overlap? All these interesting questions. But give him a follow, and he's written a bunch of really technical books, but he's got a couple of books for the general public. One of them is called The Last Superstition. And he deals with that particular subject quite a bit throughout that. So, yeah. So follow Edward Faeser and learn from his work. And with that, we're done. Thank you guys so much for joining us on episode 165. I'm just so impressed with us. I'm patting myself on the back for that.
Well, and read the Genetic Literacy Project and share that with friends and share the stories from friends, because without GLP, there's no SF and F. And, you know, this was a, you know, brainchild of that media outlet. And we really do try to highlight the good work that's shown there. So we want to be another extension of that particular media source. They do it on a shoestring. We appreciate that very much and wish to be just another way to help share the good work they do.
And if you don't support them, there is a real risk that we will have to try to sell you Birkenstocks in the middle of the show. Use coupon code FOLTA for your first order.
FOLTA for your first order of Birkenstocks. Don't wear them with socks. Or someone will accuse you of being from Eastern Europe.
There you go, folks. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.